This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is away. As the nation celebrated the 228th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence yesterday, Colonial Williamsburg in Virginia was just getting the news. One of the nation's best-known living history museums, Williamsburg, celebrated the 4th with a reenactment of Patrick Henry's reading of the Declaration of Independence for the first time. Other living history museums around the country also celebrated the 4th in historically accurate ways, whether on a western homestead in the 1830s or a main street at the turn of the last century. Since the National Park Service began establishing living history programs at its sites in the 1960s, they have become an important way that Americans learn about their history. But maintaining the past in a modern world can be a difficult and expensive undertaking. Many attractions are struggling to lure potential visitors away from amusement parks and television sets, and some historians question how well quaint visions of the past convey the true hardships of their times. Later on the show, we'll give you something to chew on, the high-stakes world of eating contests, from oysters to butter, all the food that's fit to cram. But now we focus on living history museums. If you've ever spent a summer pulling on a pinafore to go to work or dragging a plow to make your daily bread, we want to hear from you. What's it like to work in the past? And for members of the viewing public, what do you think about these museums? What works and what doesn't? And are there aspects of American history you'd like to see recreated which may have been overlooked so far? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@npr.org. And sitting across from me right now in the studio is none other than the father of our country, the first president of the United States, George Washington. Though I think to be completely accurate, in 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was signed, he was not yet president. Am I correct, Mr. Washington?
Yes, madam. You are absolutely correct. I was just a young man at that time. You can see that the presidency has turned my hair white.
I see. And perhaps you could explain to us the significance of the Declaration of Independence.
Well, actually, I never signed the document. You see, I was already appointed General of the Army, and I was in New York City with the Army, ready to march towards Boston. And I was not sure, when the declaration was read to the troops, how they would react. I sat there quietly in my headquarters, and then I heard the cheers. Huzzah! Huzzah! Oh.
And how did you expect the British to respond to this provocation? How quickly?
Well, they already had attacked the Minutemen at Lexington and Concord and militia, and they had been devastated at Bunker's Hill, sometimes known as Breed's Hill. So the war had actually started.
Did you think the colonies were prepared for war?
No, we were not. We did not know what to expect at that time. It was very difficult to discern what the British would do, and some of our own citizens were interested in reconciliation rather than revolution. More than half, I would say.
Now, I should say, because this is not a visual medium, I should tell our listeners that you are dressed in a beautiful outfit of the time in which you're living, and perhaps you could describe what you're wearing.
Yes, I will. I'm wearing the same set of clothes that I wore during the presidency when Gilbert Stuart painted my picture called the Lansdowne Portrait. It is black linen, good for the summertime.
I was going to ask if it was warm for this weather.
Well, sometimes I wonder if you've spent a winter at Valley Forge, you really can never be too warm.
Now we're going to do what thousands of tourists at Mount Vernon, the historic site Mount Vernon, are not able to do. We're going to bring President Washington out of his character and talk to the man behind the general, and that is William Summerfield. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Mr. Summerfield.
It's a pleasure. Sometimes I have difficulty separating myself from the role.
I was going to say you're a good sport for I think you took the metro here, perhaps.
not a horse and carriage.
How long have you performed, or is that the right word, performed as
yes,
President Washington?
I like that word, interpreted Washington, I would say. I started in 1989. That was my first assignment at Mount Vernon. I was assigned to the role after many auditions, by Chief Justice Warren Burger, who had resigned the court and become the commissioner for the bicentennial of the Constitution. So that was my first experience, a journey of 7 days all the way to New York City to reenact the first inauguration.
What drew you to this kind of work?
Well, I had been the editor-in-chief of several publishing houses, and they were gobbled up by other houses, and so I decided to go home and do something else. And one day my dear wife looked at me and she said, "You know, you look a great deal like Washington." That started the whole thing off.
I was going to say that that was something else I was going to point out and to our listeners who of course can see you, that you do look like George Washington. Were you particularly interested in this time in history yourself personally?
Yes, I actually studied history at the university, and I had a great interest in it. I specialized in 18th century American history, so I was to some degree prepared for the task.
How many historical interpreters would you say there are around the country at this point? Do you have any idea?
Well, I have really no idea, but I know that there are only about 10 or 11 who actually do notable characters, such as Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt and so forth, and they are among the cream of the crop. There are others who attempt it, but a 5'6" Lincoln just doesn't do it.
So one requirement in order to interpret one of these major historical figures is that you really should look like the person,
yes,
first of all.
Yes, when we start training people for these roles, we look for someone who looks a little bit like the character, or at least has the physical dimensions of the character.
Yeah. Now, I know you have a company, American Historical Theater, which trains interpreters. How do you do that? What's the preparation consist of?
That's a good question. Actually, we look for people. We look for people that resemble certain historical characters. Also, for people who have a very deep interest in history and someone who's a very good presenter.
Do they have to have an acting ability,
I presume? Well, that helps. That helps indeed. You see, it's easier to teach an actor history than it is a historian to act.
Yeah. How much about the history do they have to know? Do they have to know only the history of their particular character, or do they need a larger sense of history for the context?
Well, they need the context, of course, the social history of the times, the other events that are recurring during their lifetime. All of the things that surround the character must be incorporated into the knowledge that the interpreter has.
And how do you decide how President Washington, for instance, would really think? I mean, do you ever struggle with what your own ideas might be versus what he truly would be thinking at a given moment?
It's true. Sometimes your own ideas do get in the way, but we work like any other historian. That is, we read the documents, we read the letters, read other historians' descriptions, we conduct analysis, and then like other historians, we have this point and that point, and we construct historical jump between the two.
We are talking about the tradition of living history on Talk of the Nation. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 800-989-8255. And we're going to take a call now from Deborah in Akron, Ohio. Hi, Deborah.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, hello, President Washington. I'm calling to find out why is there... why are there not a lot of reenactments that reflect the slave experience in the America or in the United States?
Well, actually, it's very difficult to find people who can and are willing to involve themselves. Now, they do this in Williamsburg, and we have,
yes,
at Mount Vernon a slave tour, which we take people around and show them the slave burial ground and tell stories about the various slaves that were in the Washington family. And so I think there are others, but I don't really know of them.
Yes, they have a few here in Ohio since we were the site of many of the Underground Railroad
trails. Ah, yes. Now, that's a different question.
Yes.
How did the slaves during the war, much later, that is, during the Civil War, how did they actually deal with running to the north? And that's a whole new story there.
Yes. Right. But I just think our the national story needs to be complete, and we just need to take time to really focus on that period, the achievements as well as some of the bad parts.
I think you're right, and we must be absolutely honest about it. Washington himself had two slaves that escaped from Philadelphia, his chef, Hercules, who was a very talented man, and Mrs. Washington's personal slave, who was called Oney Judd. And they never returned.
All right. Oh, good. Okay.
Thanks so much for your call, Deborah.
Thank you.
Let's try and take another call now from, I think it's Leah in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Terry. Thank you so much for having this guest on. Mr. Sommerfeld, I'm working on a book on the history of battle reenacting in this country, and I know from some of the texts, such as Past into Present, that there is a distinction made between living history enactors, such as yourself, and battle reenactors, but I haven't been able to quite get the actual distinction, and I wonder if you would talk more about that for both my benefit and the benefit of people out there who may also be confused about this.
Yes, this confusion often exists. There are the reenactors, the people who are in costume and have weapons and march about, but most often they are not superlative presenters. And then you have people who are generic living history people who do people that are not actually well known. But I would say with modesty, on the top of the heap we have what I call notable historical interpreters, and all of them are easily recognized by the public. So those are the categories that I split the business of interpretation up into.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Leah.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I know that the battle reenactors tend to be very strict about staying in character, staying in the history at the moment. How important is that? How important do you think that is to stay in character?
Well, it is extremely important. What we are trying to achieve is the suspension of disbelief, as they do in the theater. And we need to continue with that. If we break the character, that effort is destroyed because you're no longer. It's just like if you're a battle reenactor and the camera catches your watch on your wrist, you're out of it.
Do you do people try and break your character when
oh, yes,
they come visit
yes.
Mount Vernon? Or?
Sometimes, yes. But the people who visit Mount Vernon are really, you can divide them into three groups. There are those who are sort of coerced, like school children, to come there. And they get caught up in the first-person interpretation. And then there are those who, grandparents and parents who bring their children because they want them the taste of history. And then we have the pilgrims who come to worship at the shrine. They are the ones you have to be careful of because their questions have a kind of ideological background.
Ah, what's the hardest question you've ever gotten? Do you know?
Yes, it was out in Portland, Oregon, and it was for 7th or 8th grade, and there were quite a few girls, and one girl raised her hand, and she said, "Mr. President, what do you wear, boxers or jockeys?"
Well, I was going to say you're not the first president to have been asked that, but actually, let's see if we can figure this out. Historically, I guess you were the first president.
Well, what I did, of course, was to launch into a description of 18th century wear and what people actually did wear. And after a while, of course, she was listening to what I said and forgot the fact that she was just trying to tweak me with her question.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, President Washington, a.k.a. William Sommerfeld.
It's a pleasure indeed, madam.
William Sommerfeld portrays President George Washington both on tour and around the country and regularly at the Mount Vernon Estate in Alexandria, Virginia. We're talking about living history museums. We want to hear from both interpreters and visitors. Does it illuminate or distort history or try to depict it in the modern era? Are there aspects of American history you think would benefit from a living history site? Give us a call, 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about living history museums. You're invited to join the discussion. If you've made a living out of living in the past, tell us about your time on the job. And if you're a historian of another stripe, do you think these sites add to or get in the way of history education for the public? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Leo Landis. He is the curator of Agriculture and Rural Life at the Henry Ford Museum and Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan. He joins us from the studios of WUOM in Ann Arbor. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Landis.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Now, the Henry Ford Museum is one of the biggest living history museums in the country, and I know you've got historic buildings from all over the country. But why do you also have people in costumes?
We find that the people who come to visit living history museums, not just Greenfield Village, enjoy interacting with people and feeling the authenticity of an era. And it's not just being in the historic setting of a period building, but also interacting with people dressed in the appropriate costume of people of the era. And it also gives the sense of authenticity and also identifying those as the people you should try to talk to when you're visiting our sites.
Have you ever been one of those people in costume? Have you ever been an interpreter?
And that's how I started out, actually, in this profession 17 years ago, was summer work as a college intern dressing in 1850s-era costume at a museum in central Iowa called Living History Farms, driving oxen and hoeing corn in 90-degree heat.
And did it give you – what was the training that you needed to do that?
As part of that work, I – had a chance to go through some orientation for about a week, and they don't turn you loose with livestock typically until you've been around for a season or so. So I was pretty good at hoeing corn by the end of that first summer in 1986 in central Iowa. And that next year is when typically historic sites will run you through a set of systematic training so that you can work with historic or work with animals in historically appropriate ways.
What are some of the sort of more difficult questions or situations that you've encountered in this business?
I think the most difficult things are really when you're doing role playing, like William was talking about, and I've done that as well. When I started out, I was what museum professionals or living history museum professionals would call a third person interpreter, where you don't do role playing, but you talk about what the past was like. And much as William alluded to, when you start getting those personal questions or asking if you're married to the people next to you, I don't know that they're difficult, but they become repetitive. And if you're the person fielding those questions, you just have to realize that these people are on that site for the first time, and they're really interested in knowing what's going on there. So you just have to steel yourself to getting asked similar questions day after day, whether that fire is hot or those clothes hot, or are you really going to eat that food?
Well, you know, I have to say that the clothes question is I'm thinking of this when I've seen people doing reenactments, for instance, the Civil War reenactments. I've gone out and interviewed some Civil War reenactors in, you know, 9,500-degree heat, and they have these heavy wool uniforms on. And the first question that comes to your mind is, aren't you hot? And I guess that's what you're talking about, the repetitive question that you get.
Right. And as I said, Lynn, you just realize that these people are genuinely interested in what's going on there, and that's the first time they've encountered you that day. So you really try to be appreciative of their interest in history and realize that they may be asking simple questions to you, but they're just the elementary. They're the questions that everybody wants to know.
It's a natural curiosity. On the other hand, I would guess that sometimes you get some smart alecks. I mean, you've got a lot of student groups coming through. I mean, do people ever try and bait you?
Oh, certainly. And you just, you know, they'll say, oh, let's see you eat that food. Let's see you eat that food, when there are a couple dozen flies swarming inside your cabin. And you just say, sure, I do this every day. And the standards that we have today are different than the standards are historically. And I grew up in a rural community. So I was used to having flies in a house with a screen door, and it didn't bother me to do that. And some children and adults just think that's the craziest thing they've ever seen.
We are talking about living history museums on Talk of the Nation today. We're going to take a call from Charlie. He's in Wichita, Kansas. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. I used to volunteer at our local living history museum, Old Cowtown, and which is a collection of buildings gathered from around the county and various areas and preserved. and oftentimes they went into different jobs than they had actually had. City halls became hotels, and other things became grocery stores and so forth. And we performed written scripts on the street called street scenes at specific times, and rotated them each weekend.
What was it, Charlie, that made you want to do this? Why were you interested in taking part in this?
Well, a professor had written a book on early Wichita history, and we got to see an early manuscript and write a play for it that we performed indoors. And then the assistant director asked us to take it outdoors for the summer. It hadn't been done before. And we were amazed that people would come out and stand in 90-degree heat and watch people in Victorian costumes perform and talk to each other.
And what'd you get out of it?
A lot of weekends when we didn't go to the lake. But no, great. It was when there were crowds of any size, or even performing for two or three or four people. If it was 2 o'clock, you went out and did the bank clerk or the cattle drover or the homesteader.
But did you get a greater sense of history from having done this, having experienced this?
Yes, and I was curious to know more about, because there's always that controversy of first and third person, but when we were in costume, we stayed in first person.
Okay, thanks so much for your call.
Well, you're welcome.
Okay, good talking to you. Let's take another call now from Tony, and he's in Germantown, Maryland. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. Go ahead.
Well, I was calling in response to your first caller. I work for a nonprofit organization called the Monnaie Foundation in Germantown, Maryland, and we're actually restoring a 1790s plantation, former slave plantation, about 25 miles out of Washington, D.C., and we're going to operate it as a working mid-19th century Maryland slave plantation, and we're going to be doing something that's kind of falls between living history reenactment and what they do at Williamsburg, because our interpreters are going to actually live on the site year-round. And everything from the clothing they wear to the food that they eat will be produced on-site and used, drawing from the agricultural records of the time. And then...
And let me just ask you something. Are you saying that people are going to live there as slaves year-round?
People are going to live there as 19th century people, whether they are the white people who live in the big house or a handful of the slaves who live in the outbuildings. And what they're going to do is a program that actually has visitors come in for 48 hours, literally blindfolded and transported to the site, changed into slave clothing, and literally thrown into the past. So whether you're black, white, Asian, or whatever, you can actually get a hands-on experience living and working on a 19th century Maryland slave plantation.
Now, have you begun hiring people for this, or do you have people who are involved in the creating of it who are interested in taking on these parts?
Yes, and we haven't gotten to the hiring stage right now. It's a some might say it's a pretty outlandish endeavor to begin with, but it's actually based on a program that we designed to train Oprah Winfrey for her role in Beloved, where we actually brought her to a Maryland plantation and gave her a sensory experience in slavery. And because we want the greatest degree of authenticity, we're kind of taking slow steps. So right now we work off of a 50-acre farm in Germantown, Maryland, where we're testing our crops, beginning to train interpreters, bring on artisans who will create the material culture of the 19th century. And once we pilot some of the programs and get feedback from the public, we'll then move our operations to the large plantation, which really is a step back in time. And our goal is less to teach people about slavery than it is to actually use the backdrop of slavery as a way of presenting a program which has people confront what enslaves them in the present.
Thanks for your call, Tony. I want to just get our guest in on the conversation now, but I appreciate your – this is a very interesting response to the questions that are often raised about this, which is how do you get some of the difficult parts of our history involved in these living history museums, slavery, disease, the oppression of women, these kinds of things.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to reply to Tony's comments there, Lynn. There are a number of members of the Association of Living History Farms and or Living History Farm and Agricultural Museums that offer overnight programs or weekend programs like that. Norlands, a site in Maine, has a program where you can spend a number of days on site, as well as does a site in central Indiana called Connor Prairie. But getting to those difficult questions, Connor Prairie is at least one of the sites that has a long tradition of addressing issues like temperance, at least in the 19th century, or women's rights or funerals, and really addressing social history issues that have been problematic. And I think in reply to Deborah's comment at the start of the program, in addition to the slavery that's addressed at Colonial Williamsburg, she rightly referenced a lot of the underground railroad programs that are going on throughout the U.S. now and into Canada as well. Connor Prairie also offers an underground railroad program. There's a church in the Detroit area that is offering an underground railroad program where you really are thrust into very confrontational situations as a visitor to try to make you and help you identify both with the complexities of history, but really let you live the history as well as a member of the public who isn't the museum professional in the historic costume, but a visitor. And I think there's a lot of orientation that has to happen there, but it can be a very powerful experience for American and other visitors.
All right, let's see if we can get one more call in here. BJ in Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, BJ.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Well, I've been doing this for 16 years.
You work at Williamsburg, yes. Then, you're saying.
Uh-huh. I've been working at Williamsburg for 25 years. I've been portraying an 18th century person since 1989.
Uh-huh.
And for the last few years, portraying George Wythe, who was Thomas Jefferson's law teacher and one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and a person of some consequence around here, especially as his house is still standing. I started dialing when Washington was on, so I'm a little bit out of it.
You wanted to talk to Washington, I guess.
Well, no, I was reacting to some things you're saying.
Uh-huh. Do you ever get, do the lines between reality and fiction or reality and history ever get crossed for you?
I find that doing an 18th century character is a little bit like learning a second language.
Uh-huh.
It's just like someone who speaks two languages doesn't throw in words from one language into the other language very frequently. He knows which track he's on. And I think if once you get to a place where you can think along the lines that your character is thinking and have the assumptions about the world that your character has, then you can react pretty automatically in the context of his time and place and understanding without having, you know, your modern ideas infiltrate. Although if you get really into someone's skin, you begin to understand them to the point where you begin to sympathize with them.
Hmm.
And they're thinking, as you understand their thinking more profoundly, it starts influencing your thinking also. There's several layers to it. You're at the same time being very authentic, but you also want to connect to people's modern experience. So if you can emphasize some aspect of the past that may or may not resonate with things in the present, then that can sometimes make a connection.
All right.
You know, for example, the world's changed a lot recently, so some of my interpretations portraying the end of the American Revolution, I reflect on how odd it is that the French, who were once our enemies, are now our allies and friends. The British, who were once our fellow countrymen and our dearest friends, are now our enemies, and the world is turned upside down. And I hope that people will think, oh, gee, that sounds familiar somehow. And make a connection there. So it's always fun when you can do that, when you can layer it, so you're getting layers of complexity into the interpretation. And sometimes people only perceive the surface stuff, sometimes they perceive layers.
Sometimes they get what you're trying to do.
And sometimes you can inject some irony into it so that they can also realize that the character is revealing more than he thinks he's revealing. That he's saying something about his assumptions that he isn't consciously saying, but the 20th century person could pick up on it.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, BJ.
Sure.
We're talking about living history museums, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm just wondering, Leo Landis, in terms of these living history museums, you're competing with an awful lot of other, shall we say, entertainment out there. Are you finding it hard to attract people? What is it like for these living history museums in terms of competing with some of the other kinds of things that people might want to go to in the summertime? Are they still very popular or what?
You're dead on that there's a tough competition for the leisure time and dollars of the American public. And so some sites have had difficulty with tight budgets either on a local or a state level. And it's been a problem for some sites. A city site in Austin, Texas closed down last fall because the city just simply couldn't support its operation. A very good living history site called Jordan Bachman Farm. And the state of Illinois had to scale back the hours of some of their living history sites in 2002. And so they aren't open to the public typically on Mondays and Tuesdays. And Minnesota Historical Society had some budgetary issues because of funding from the state and also had to limit programming at some of their historic sites, their living history sites. And then in our case at Greenfield Village, we did a restoration of Greenfield Village last year that some people felt took some chances, but it now has made the village a much more navigable place, we feel. It's a very big facility. We're on over 80 acres with over 70 historic structures. But we think that we had a major boost in attendance last year, and so that if you're able to dedicate the resources and take some risks, you can have a positive public experience still and still attract the public. And that's one of the challenges, I think, that's facing living history sites all over over North America anyway.
And I would think, too, that in terms of trying to attract people, there's a thin line that you might have to tread in terms of not wanting to sanitize things too much so that people still want to come and yet at the same time being truthful to history.
That's exactly right. And so I think sites have really started to take more risks in the last 15 to 20 years. Many sites have instituted Native American programs. I think of Plymouth Plantations, Native American programming. I referenced Connor Prairie earlier. They also instituted a Native American program in the last 5 years. And Living History Farms in Central Iowa and a number of other sites across the U.S. have really tried to address interaction between Native peoples as well and European settlers, in addition to just addressing the pioneer period.
Thanks for joining us, Mr. Landis. Leo Landis is curator of agricultural and rural life at the Henry Ford Museum in Michigan. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation. It's Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary. We're going to continue our discussion of living history, and then we're going to move on to something entirely different. Eating contest. So if you'd like to call us about either subject, the number is 1-800-989-8255. Right now, for those of us without the weekend to spend at a Mount Vernon or the Alamo, public television's made living history easy with programs that turn the past into reality TV. Shows like Pioneer House and Colonial House allow PBS viewers to watch modern participants struggle with historical challenges. These experiments often provide modern learning experiences for the participants. Here's Colonial House member Don Wood.
I've learned how fulfilling it can be to live in a way where what you work on and do immediately benefits you, like milking a goat and then drinking that milk later that day, chopping wood and burning the wood to heat yourself later that night without all the middlemen and stuff. I've learned that, I guess. I learned a lot about groups of people, living with groups of people. I've learned also that I'm just still the same person no matter where I go, no matter what happens. I'm just stuck with myself. So I've learned that.
PBS's version of the past may be educational for its participants, but how good is it on history? Joining us now is Emerson Baker, chair of the history department at Salem State College and the historical consultant to Colonial House. He joins us from the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts. Thanks for being with us.
Sure, Lynn. Glad to be here.
Tell me, were there some accommodations that the show had to make that you found frustrating as an historian?
Well, I guess you expect some things. You expect that people are going, in Maine in the middle of the summer, are going to need insect repellent and suntan lotion. So that wasn't a real problem. I guess to me it was, there were some compromises, but it was just a wonderful opportunity for people to really explore early American history, which, quite frankly, you really rarely get to see on television.
Yeah, I did read an article that you wrote that mentioned something I found interesting, which is that a colony at that time would have, in a sense, have been like a military establishment, which was something that they could not portray. Why not?
Well, there are lots of things that are difficult to portray. For safety reasons, they didn't want to give 17th century muskets to the colonists. And that means that you can't have militia drill and musket training. And there are aspects like that it's very, very difficult, admittedly, to catch on TV. You can only sort of catch slices. And my friends find it hard to believe, but when I say, you only have 8 hours of television, you can only do so much. I think unless you've been involved in it, it's hard to understand how much of an early experience you just can't get into television.
How valid do you think these kinds of programs are? I mean, is this a good way for people to get their history from a program like this?
Well, I think it's a good start. My one concern is that this doesn't take away from living history museums. And Plymouth Plantation, of course, consulted extensively on Colonial House, and I worked with Plymouth for a long time on projects. And I think we're all feeling that, we hope that we can use this as a way to really sort of tickle people's interests in living history museums. And maybe someone who's seen Colonial House on TV is going to be more likely to come to a Plymouth Plantation or a Sturbridge Village or a Colonial Williamsburg. So I don't see it as being the sole source of your history, but I think it's a good start.
I didn't see Colonial House. I saw, I think it was Manor House.
Right.
But I was fascinated by that. And what really I was struck by was how quickly these people took to their roles, for the most part. Actually, in that case, the people who lived very well took very well to their roles.
Isn't it? Yeah, they really do, and I think you see it in the Colonial House as well too, where people who once they get in the habit of being in positions of power and authority, it's very easy to fall into that. But I really think the true heroes of Colonial House were the servants, because that was the toughest job, was to really sort of become subservient, and you have modern day people who are not used to taking orders, who were really committing themselves to a few months of doing the hard work, of doing the tough jobs, and I think to me they were sort of the unsung heroes of the show.
So you would do it again then?
Well, I would certainly be involved in another project. It was a lot of fun, and as I say, I think a great way to start doing to giving people that flavor of what life was like in early America.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay.
Emerson Baker was the historical consultant on PBS's Colonial House. He currently chairs the history department at Salem State College in Massachusetts. He joins us today from the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts.